All right, everyone, let's go ahead and get started. So thanks for joining us today for our final class in the series entitled Engaging Islam. Before we get started, just one housekeeping note. At some point today, Marshall will take a picture of all the attendees should contact tracing become necessary. But without further ado, please help me welcome Imam Yavad Bayat, Manager of Pastoral Care and Clinical Pastoral Education for Penn Medicine Princeton Health and Princeton House Behavioral Health, as he presents A Child of Refugees Becoming an Afghan American Muslim.
Hello, hello? Yes, there you go. It's very fancy. I decided to stand because I think folks in the back would be able to see me better, and I'm gonna take off my mask. Is that okay? Yeah. Our faces. So when I was asked about this presentation, I think that folks are already aware that there are some Afghan refugees that this church is sponsoring, and this became a conversation between Holly and I, and just how about what could be really useful. But this is also very personal to my story. So what I'm gonna present to you is a very personal journey. Yes, I could talk about Islam and all those dynamics really well, but I wanna provide you insider knowledge about the experience that my family underwent in becoming refugees in 1981 during the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, and then what implications that led to, and like even in my birth in 1988. So I do want this to be more of an engagement and a conversation, and because it's insider kind of an experience, I want you to feel welcome to ask me about the textures of what was going on in my inner landscape. And it's very much in line with clinical pastoral education as well. It's about narrative and storytelling and trying to understand a person's frame and then navigating those spaces. So that's my introduction. I have a life transitions timeline that I will refer to, but I'm not going to do that just yet. I want to start with where I am today in terms of my family. So I'm married to my wife, and her name is Eloha. She is a British, Afghan, Iranian, American.
Whoa.
Yeah, right. It's amazing, and I'll tell you why. She, during her parents, I'm gonna condense things and then we'll expand it should you have questions. Basically went to Iran as refugees. So she was then born there in 1988. And then her mom had British kind of permanent residency in a sense, but not, she wasn't a citizen there, but she was able to access that space because she lived there for a little bit. So what happened is they then left to England a little later on, and then and then they became British. They had the British passports, and then we got together. I met her a few times. I started courting her in a long distance kind of relationship, and then she was able to come here in 2013. She became a citizen in 2017. American, British, Afghan, Iranian woman. We have two daughters. One name is Ariana. Ariana is actually the ancient name for Afghanistan, Persia, back in the day. So we chose a name that speaks very close to that experience of our heritage. And our second child's name is Aida. She's 2 months old. The other one's 19 months. And so this is, we're a family of four, and it's probably growing. My wife was telling me about potentially having a third, but we'll. I said, let's just enjoy the second for now. and then there's my mom and dad, and I have two sisters. My oldest sister is 15 years older than I am, and the other one is 11 years older. My oldest sister has two sons, and my other sister has two daughters. I'm going to reference this more, but I want you to understand where we ended up to today as I tell my story a little bit more. And so my oldest sister in 2005 married a white man who had converted to Islam. But it was a strange circumstance in terms of how they ended up and got married, and that's part of the narrative and the story. My second sister in 2007 or 8 married a Polish man who did not convert to Islam, and this is a real big focal point about our narratives and like why it matters that I'm even naming it like this. And so that's where it leads to today. That's my family. We're like, what was it, 10 or 11? However, my oldest sister had divorced my ex-brother-in-law back in 2016, which brought about some other things as well. So that's where we are today. Now let me start with before. Maybe I'll just keep this up. So this is, you're not gonna be able to read this. That's not relevant. It's relevant for me, so I can point it out. What I want to show you is, it says 1992 to 2021. I'm born in 1988. I'm in blue are big moments of disruption in my worldview. In green are like these moments of change, transition. In red are deaths. And all of these are big evaluation periods of how I started to understand and grapple with the world, but a lot of it had to do with also the intergenerational trauma that I was bearing witness to through all of these moments, okay? So let me start with before I was born, before I had any idea what was going on. I'm gonna name a few facts. So the first one is that my mom and dad married in 1972 in Afghanistan, in Kabul, Afghanistan. Folks here probably are familiar with maybe the world of Afghanistan and the news and all that. There was a lot of tourism at that point. Maybe it was known for drawing in a lot of that. During my parents' like youth and marriage, things were blossoming. I mean, the Kabul was green. There was traffic lights that worked. You know, the food was, you know, like things were developing. In 1964, women started having the ability to vote, and they had women in parliament before we in America even had any. So it was growing like this. And this is 1972. It was still a monarchy, but it was an interesting kind of one. There was still a parliament. And I think it was in 1972 or 1973, there was a change in government, but from the perspective of where my parents stood, it wasn't much of a difference. It became a Democratic Party or something like that. The cousin overthrew the king. So that was, it basically, the power stayed in the family. And so things were pretty much developed. My dad and my mom, you know, my mom just graduated high school. They got married at the age of, she got married at the age of 18. He was 23 or 24. And she finished high school, went to get her teaching, kind of the equivalent of a degree, and began teaching. My dad finished pharmacy program, was a pharmacist. Both of my grandparents were very wealthy at the time, very wealthy, and they had lots of businesses. They would go to Germany, England. They were trying to develop the infrastructure of Afghanistan in a way. I mean, medicine is a way that we can live to the age that we can today. And that was part of what they noticed was an opportunity to help the country, but also an opportunity for the family. It's not unlike what we do in democratic countries, right? So you kill two birds with one stone in a way. So they had this kind of business, and they were constantly expanding, and their dads were in partnership. They were in the same company. And so he was gonna stay in the family and work there. They had this vision of what life was gonna be. Maybe many of you can relate to that, right? Maybe I'm gonna end up working and taking over the reins after my parents, right? Or things of that nature, work in the same company. My two sisters were born, and again, developing. What happens, 1978, 1979, it was a very bloody kind of transition. The ruler at that point, Daoud Khan, he was, I think he was killed or whatever, he was ousted. Two people came in, and it was a very strange regime. But they were under the influence of Soviet kind of communist don't want to say brain control, but they were influenced a lot by that thought pattern and restricting people's rights. And if you don't, anything that threatened power was a threat. So folks who had money were a threat. Folks who were minorities, then the people in power were a threat. So my family comes from the background of being Shia Muslims. And Shia Muslims also were not, and are not, back then, a welcome kind of space. So suspicion, right? My grandfather, this is what's going to happen. I'm going to be really brief about this. In 1979, my one grandfather is taken by the Soviet Afghans, and basically, to keep it short, we never saw him again. We didn't know what happened. They came, they knocked on his door at night. They said, "Oh, we're just going to take you for a little bit, and we'll bring you back." Never came back. We don't even know what happened to him for a long period of time up until 2013. In 2013, we learned that, and I think it was in Norway, one of the Afghan Soviets had all this paperwork, the paperwork of people they killed. And the reason they gave was that he was a Khomeini, meaning that he was a supporter of Khomeini, which isn't true. But it was because of his religious affiliation, and the fact that he was wealthy as well. They were concerned that he was going to use his resources to fight against the regime. And so my other grandfather was taken prisoner for about 2 years, but he stayed in prison, and he stayed there until 1981. My dad was taken for 1 week. They were interrogating him, and they released him after, I don't know how, but they released him. I think he still is like wondering, why did they release me? This is all 1981, you know, two little girls at home. My mom's like, what's gonna happen? And so this is how I understand what's happening. So in 1981, my grandfather is released because the Soviets actually landed in Afghanistan this time. They're saying, like, you guys messed up, we're gonna come clean up the matter. So they were like, we're gonna just fix all of everything, right? And you're shaking your head, you probably remember the kind of this experience of what was on the news. And so they come in, you know, saying that they're gonna be saviors. They release my grandfather. My grandfather stays inside the house, gets his paperwork, and makes sure that he can get to Germany, where he had some resources to try to get all his family out, the grandfather that lived. So he stayed put, and all at once he left in a matter of months. My dad and mom and my two sisters, they left to India with they left to India really as fast as they could as well after he left, and they stayed there for 6 months. It was a church organization that in America that helped them come here to the States. Of course, they had to pay back some of that, but they helped get them here in 1981. It was September 30th, 1981. So they lived here, and now they're here in America. I'm not born until 1988, so they're getting their bearings. They're trying to understand, like, you know, they're recreating their life. So now here, this is where I want to start, where I come in to the picture, and then I'm going to now reference back. So these are facts or maybe some interpretive points of what happened from before I was born, but also what I inherited. That grandfather that I named who left, he also helped almost everyone of our extended family come to America as well in terms of resources. He died in 1992. That was a huge rupture in our community. Because of what he represented for folks. But I want to get into my narrative a bit. So I'm going to take a sip of water here. If folks have any questions up until now, feel free to ask. Or anything that was of interest there.
Where were you living?
Come again?
What city in the United States were you in?
Do I live in now?
No, then.
Back then.
1988, I was born in Morristown, New Jersey. So, and we grew up in Lake Hiawatha, which is Parsippany. So that was that. Yeah, that was born there. My parents, when they came in 1981, they moved to New York City first. And then after 4 or 5 months, my grandfather did actually come to America. Everyone gathered at his home, and that was in Parsippany, New Jersey. Everyone was like living in this big house. He was using whatever funds he had to gather everyone. And fortunately, we did. We were able to do that. So I'm born 1988. I'm very ignorant to these realities. I mean, how would I even know any of that? But what I know is how I was felt. So, I mean, let me ask, I think it's safe to assume that in whichever context you're in, be at work here, in a new context, a new, maybe if you've done some traveling, you might have wondered, where do I fit in? Where do I belong? What do I do here? What do I do now? Can I ask this question? Just imagine that now being the textures of, like, my life. I remember I was 6 years old, my mom was walking me to school, and she was asked, and I asked her, you know, when I speak to my peers there in Farsi, would they understand me? You know, like, that's such a cute question, and it also kind of tells you that I'm already becoming aware of my difference. And so this was, and my mom just like, she was like, yeah, they're going to understand. So make sure you don't say anything stupid. My mom was doing the best that she could with the tools that she had. And I'm making my way, and they have no precedence for what is it like to be in a new, totally new context when you had your life already settled, you already had your future kind of, you already could anticipate your future, and boom, disrupted, gone. Just like in overnight. They left with literally two suitcases. I think you probably might have heard about something like this for folks who were refugees. They like left with like a suitcase, or maybe just a Bible. I've had other students who are refugees who just like left their country with just a Bible because they don't want to bring any attention to themselves as like missionaries, so to speak, and they got out of the country. In any case.
So your parents have been in America for 8 years by the time you're born, 7 years,
yeah.
Whatever. How have they settled? What have they created for themselves?
That
they
before I was born, yeah. Because of the wealth, that some of the residual wealth that my grandfather had, he had a son, my uncle, who came to the States in 1977, 78, because he was trying to flee a unhealthy relationship. So he came here for his own personal reasons. But he also set the seeds for what was going to come. It was a restaurant. And so 1981, they have this restaurant business on 2nd Avenue between 73rd and 74th, which they closed in 2005. But it was pretty successful. It was in New York Times. They had 2 stars. And so in that space, it's like, wow, 2 stars. You know, in the 1990s. So he came here with all those education, and he didn't pursue that, although he could have. My mom really wanted him to. It was actually a real source of conflict in their relationship, because as my mom tells a story, he chose his brothers over their own family. If he would have became a pharmacist, he would have been able to have had more wealth for us and their daughter and their kids at the time. But instead, he chose what, and it's pretty understandable, in the time of disruption, choosing what was most secure and most grounding. And he stayed with his siblings. So they had a restaurant business, and they stayed there, and he became like the general manager of the store and also the quality control for the food. He learned a lot of those skills from observing my grandmother. And he did that up until 2008, 2009, when he had a heart attack. And it made him reevaluate things, but he also really didn't. He loves cooking even till today, but it wasn't like his passion for a job. Does that help?
Thank you.
And I'm born in 1988 with him working that kind of a lifestyle, hardly seeing him, but also like wondering like where do I fit in? What's happening is in blue here. I write loss of childhood innocence related to identity and belonging. And I'm noticing my voice is a bit subdued. It's in the morning for me. So I hope that folks aren't getting too sleepy with me talking. I've been told that it's very soothing. That's why I'm saying that. So it's great for patient care, you know, providing support to patients and their families and staff. I always get, oh, wow, you're so non-anxious. But I realized that for a presentation, it may not be as engaging. But yeah, I'm going to use some humor to help you stay awake. So loss of childhood innocence related to identity and belonging. I write that that happens in 1968, 1996 into 1998. I must have been maybe 5 to 8 years old, maybe 9 years old. And what I mean is just that question. Remember that anecdote I told you about, like, will they understand me? Because there was things like this happening. On my hand, I had this henna. Folks know what henna is? Yeah. So this is was on my hand, but it wasn't beautified. There was no flowers, anything like that. In Afghan culture, this is oftentimes placed on the hand of guests, even. But I was at weddings, and I would want it. It was really cool. All the kids wanted it on their hands. It was part of the experience. And go to school, and what happens? I'm sent to the nurse's office, and I'm trying to tell them that this is a thing from a wedding, and she's not believing me. It doesn't matter how much language I'm using, she's rubbing it off, washing it, trying to, you know, it was, in a way, it's hilarious. In another way, I'm like, what is wrong with you?
What did you think it was?
As a 6 or 7 year old, I didn't have the mental capacity to actually ask her. I think she thought I was being abused. A bruise, yeah, but she's, because it wasn't coming off. They're like, how did this thing get on him? And I'm like, I don't understand how to explain this to you. And they call my home, and then they tell her it's from a wedding. But this is the kind of disorienting space I'm in as a first or second grader. And again, I don't really have too much context about the fact that my family came here as refugees. Right, I'm Afghan, I'm 6, 7 years old, I want to play. And I'm having these, these behaviors. And I believe, you know, she was giving her the benefit of the doubt. I think she was doing her due diligence. But at the same time, it was very disorienting for me. Also because I know for sure she wasn't really hearing me. There wasn't a curiosity, there was more of the, we're going to fix this problem, you get that stain out of your hand, kind of orientation. I think the reason that this memory is very, very clear in my mind was that it was very visceral. It was very much on my body, you know. And I remember her trying to wash it off. And I think that that's probably a good metaphor of what my childhood felt like. Like I was trying to wash off my Afghan identity, my Muslim identity, in a way. This is really weird. And that is highlighted by some of the bullying that I experienced. I remember there was girls who were interested in me in elementary school, and the boys would get very jealous and push me against the thing. But I was very different. Also from that, I didn't know how to make sense of it. One story I can tell is that it was because of my difference. You can probably just put it to kids' stuff too. But I think it's about the compounding factors. I think all kids struggle with these things, and then it's like these other things, like how do you make sense of that? Because also in my own home, dating boys and girls, how we relate up until a certain age, it's more open. But then because of expectations around modesty, it stops. So even like that was very confusing. How do I relate to girls? Yeah. Yes.
Were there other children in the school from other ethnic backgrounds? Yeah. New Jersey's a gateway state.
Yeah, it really is.
So there's generally,
yeah. In the mid-90s in Bergenfield, New Jersey, which is where, after Parsippany was very diverse, and there was a lot of Afghans at that school. So when I moved to Bergenfield, New Jersey, which is Bergen County, it was very ethnically diverse in a way, but also wasn't in the particular classrooms I was at. There were more Latinos, African Americans, and white folks, but more white folks. More Euro-Americans in there. I was the only one who was Muslim definitely Afghan, but the only Muslim in that school. When I went to middle school, more Muslims, but I'm the only Afghan, but we were also like othered. Like it was just a really strange experience. Like the way you see me right now, you know, I don't have a long beard or anything of that nature, what you might stereotypically understand what Muslims might look like. But there were people who looked like that in that school, and I didn't even identify with them either. I couldn't, like I didn't, it was just a really strange space of ambiguity for me as a child. And again, it's very relevant to be in that space of where do I belong, right? I mean, that's, I don't think that goes away. I don't care how old you are. But I think the feelings of like caring as much might dissipate in time. But I think at that age, I think it's very much part of the human experience for adolescence and childhood. But then you have compounding factors of like, but I don't actually understand where I came from. Why are we here? Why don't I look like them? Like, it's all visual. It's all very tangible kind of experiences. Like, why don't I look like all of you in this room, right? It's like that's basically the main question. And here my parents are during this period of time trying to explain what happened. So I'm learning about, oh, this is what happened to your grandfather. This is what happened, why you don't have a grandmother. My mom's mom died in childbirth at the age of 27, 28, 29, you know? I mean, like, talking about medicine, you know, she gave birth at the home and she had lost so much blood, and that both her child and she died. May she rest in peace. So this is all part of like the stories that I'm learning about. And I'm trying to understand it all. Come into, you know, this I wrote bullying and belonging. So talk about ethnic, right? You asked the question. So in Bergenfeld, where I started to relate to others, there was a lot of Filipinos, a lot of Latinos, a lot of African Americans, a lot of white Euro-Americans, no one that looked like me, but I could very easily blend in with those who were Latino looking because of my skin color, my complexion. But the folks that really resonated with, culturally speaking, were the Filipinos. But then again, I wasn't, because of the collectivistic nature of how they saw family, parents, the values, but still didn't really mesh. So I'm like, where do I go? Where do I belong? But what this placed me in was in a very strange position. Generally speaking, here's what it was. Because of my desire to really belong and be with them, I also would, understandably so perhaps, put myself in positions where I would, just awkward positions of being poked, teased. My desire to really want to belong made sure that I also, that's all, that teasing or that bullying or that space was more important in a way. I'm trying to figure out how to connect it, but I remember putting my place in the place of also desiring that belonging, but it was coming at this huge expense. Now, I hope you're hearing that this is me framing it in the space of agency and autonomy, because part of my growth has been trying to forgive myself for placing myself in those positions. Yes, the folks in those spaces are also bear a sense of responsibility, but in terms of my own growth, and I said that part of how I'm gonna talk about this is in the space of assimilation, isolation, and integration. So that also means I have to reckon with the role I play as I navigate otherness. And that's an example of that. Now, I think the biggest highlight comes, perhaps as it does for many, in around 2007, 2008. That's when I first entered college, and I was always struggling in school. Didn't really have a passion for education in a way. I really wanted to belong. So a lot of my stresses were like having to do with friends. Throughout this whole narrative, even though I had two older sisters, they were out in college, they weren't at home. It was just my mom and dad really raising almost like an only child. And so I'm trying to figure out how to survive in multiple ways. So I could survive, but I couldn't thrive in a way.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Was there a mosque or any religious mooring for you during this time?
Yeah. And so part of the segue here was I was growing up in an Afghan isolated kind of mosque that also resembled how my parents were educating me. In other words, life happens and you just get on with it. You don't talk about the feelings related to those experiences, the spiritual kind of disruptions. Those experiences that I was feeling in terms of like bullying or belonging, there wasn't this commentary related to it. And the mosque that I grew up in, which I still attend now, is representative of that as well. So this mosque, in 2007, 2008, I realized for the first time, I was like, whoa, this mosque that I've been growing up with is almost like mini Afghanistan. So this became a space for folks to affirm all of that things that they lost. And we weren't even using English in those that mosque setting. And almost every lesson that was being taught on the mantle or the, you know, at the altar, our equivalent of the altar, was so repetitive and had nothing to do with my experience. And so in 2007, 2008, going into college, I'm assimilating more so. I'm shedding away my particular particularities in a way even more so. I wanted to fit in. I started dressing in certain ways and you know, nightclubs, things of this nature that really even culturally doesn't make sense in a way in terms of what my mosque was teaching. My mosque was teaching, don't look like anyone else, make sure you don't pick up too much of their resemblances. And so here I was doing the opposite of that. But I started suffering in school and I was really doing terrible with my grades. And so I was like, is this what my life is coming to? I mean, like I'm trying to. And so in 2000, this is what happens then. I'm gonna stop, I think, in 5 minutes so I can invite more questions like this. Because I am missing some things, but I'm trying to give you the inner landscape of this all. My dad had that restaurant, and one of the chefs there, I think he noticed over the months, the weeks that I was working there, he noticed that I was a bit conflicted. And he said to me, sitting me down, always was a gentle soul. I loved going to the restaurant and having him give me food. He always gave it with a smile. It was just wonderful. So we already had some rapport. So we were sitting down, we're talking. He said, you know, speaking in Farsi, he says, Jawad, tell me about your life. I mean, you're 19 years old, you say? Yeah, I was like, yeah. I was like, doesn't it feel like it all has passed in like 19 minutes in a way? I was like, yeah. And he was like, whatever you're going through, if you pray, and I don't know, he names a verse from the Quran, but I didn't know that at the time, which is this: "Rabbana atana fid dunya hasana wa fil akhirati hasanatan wa qina adhab an-nar," which is Rabbana atana fid dunya. It's about garnering the good in this world and garnering the good in the hereafter, and to save yourself from the punishment of hellfire. And he's saying that if you were to pray and turn to God, you'll get good in this world and good in the hereafter. And he's saying, all you have to do is just submit, you know, in this way. But I was like, I heard this message all this time, but this time I'm in a space of suffering and pain, and my wall is cracked. And so I'm like in fertile ground, and I'm like listening, and tears start coming to my eyes. And I have like spiky hair at this point, and you probably can't tell at this, what my hair looks like right now. And, you know, I used to wear like a magnetic earring on my right ear, and that hurt. You can imagine, right? It's like keeps digging in there. And so this is to give you the image of what's where I'm at. And I sit down and I'm out there and I'm like, I go home. And I said, I gave a shot to everything except for God. Maybe I can give God a shot. And this sounds like a born-again experience, but this is how I would say is when I became Muslim. I was born Muslim. I always knew I was Muslim, culturally speaking. This is when I noticed that I surrendered. So the word Islam comes from two words, which is peace and surrender. It's the peace that one gets when one surrenders the will to God. This is really what I experienced at that moment. It was a lot leading up to that moment, and it was an epiphany in a way. And so I continued doing some of the practices, but this time with this like religiosity. So what happens is, I I do this, but then I start learning more about Islam and I start isolating, but in a very, how do you say this, in a very orthodox fashion of being very hypervigilant about my relationship with women, making sure I don't shake hands, make sure, and within our frame, we respect women in that way, Muslim and non-Muslim. It was a very disorienting practice, to say the least, and I can say more about that. And because I'm in a teaching environment, that was my bachelor's degree, and so what do we know about demographics of most public schools is that it's taught with many women as opposed to men. And I'm in this environment choosing to do something that's really a choice. I'm trying to lean into one of the values or the cultural kind of expectations, also Islamically guided by law, and I'm really disoriented and disrupted. I was like, here, I'm doing something that's really affirming my faith, but at the same time, it's really disorienting others and actually hurting people's feelings. I could see it, the embarrassment come in their face, especially if it's in the public setting, and it's hurting me. But I'm learning a lot. I even considered going to Iran to go to seminary there so I can come back. Decided not to, with the help of my mother and some other folks who were intervening in a way. It felt like an intervention, but it was like a supportive intervention. My one saving grace, in a way, and I am using that word, is that my intention to go there was not for the sake necessarily of learning, but it was to see closeness to God. And that was actually what it was, and also to affirm the dignity and self-worth of almost every human being. It wasn't necessarily to gain knowledge, it was to be able to gain knowledge that can apply to help my life in a way that it did when I first had that epiphany. That was it. It wasn't to necessarily come back and be clergy, it was to go there to learn so I could improve my life and those around me. And that was how, but it also birthed lots of learning. And so here's what happens. That's also when I'm getting married. I'm in the process of courting my wife, my sisters, and then I begin seminary in 2013. I went to Hartford International University, formerly known Hartford Seminary. This program became I was listening to Krista Tippett, yeah? And she was interviewing Ingrid Mattson. And at the end of the interview, she says, Ingrid Mattson is the director of Islamic Chaplaincy Program at the Hartford Seminary. And I was like, what is this Islamic Chaplaincy Program? I told you already that I had this desire there, but part of that desire was because of the wrestling, struggling, and integration of holding multiple worldviews and trying to make it fit into me, this body. And this Islamic chaplaincy program now becomes a space where I applied for, and took a year of discernment, really. It was a year of discernment. And here's where this being a child of refugees, where like the holding the expectations of the world comes on to me. When I was pursuing my teaching degree, my parents were like, are you gonna make enough money and be able to support your family? Is this the kind of legacy you wanna live? That was really hard. And then doing this, they're like, is there gonna be any jobs for you? Like, it was just such a, talk about like in this, especially in the context we're at right now, a lot of what's in the mainstream is follow your passions, follow your intuition, do that and all the things will follow you. That is not how it's like growing up. There's too much at stake. They leave their country, they disrupted their whole life, not out of a choice of their own. Like they could have stayed, but they would have died. So yes, they made a choice to affirm life. And they come here and I'm now aware of all this and I'm trying to balance out these worldviews. But there was nothing I was more sure about than knowing that this is the fit for me and what I had looked into. But it was a challenge really even trying to navigate their fears. Now, growing up in this Afghan environment, part of what we do unconsciously is absorbing people's fears and uncertainty and making it my own. So, I mean, the folks are familiar with like family systems theory. I mean, talk about the herd becoming rippled by the fear, right? Someone has the fear, like the sheep has it, they come in and the whole herd is like scared. Like that's very much, like it's very herd-like in that way, and I'm feeling all this like disruption, like am I doing this? And is this gonna work out? I have no idea, there's no precedence. I am a pioneer in the work of what I'm doing. I didn't know that then, that it would lead to where I am today. But at the time, I'm like, whoa. I knew I was gonna leave my family in New Jersey and that I was gonna be going to study there. I traveled to Indonesia, the Sultan of Oman, Poland, Germany. I was doing a lot of traveling as well. But it all started with me realizing that this program, this Islamic chaplaincy program, is the program I was seeking in terms of what it could offer for me in terms of the gift, my vocational discernment, where a great passion meets a great gift. And so here's what it was. I was like, this is something that where I'm able to pursue that which inspired me so many times I can give to others in terms of applied spirituality. And so that's where it started, and I started doing my clinical pastoral education work later on. And I want to then fast forward till today. So Ida is born 2 months ago, and I'm talking to my mother, and I'm noticing her distance. She's a bit, cold is not the word, but cool. She's staying with us, so is my mother-in-law. I don't know how many folks here, when your child is born for the mother, like you have everyone staying there for about 2 months, like in my family, right? Like just a few months ago, my mother-in-law was there, my mom was there, all in my home. And it was working. It was hard, but it was working. But that's also what's to be expected as well. But so we're in this space, and I'm noticing this coolness for my mom, kind of distance, a reservation. A few weeks ago, I was just sitting with her, and we had this conflict in a way where I told her, I'm gonna come over to your house for a night, and I wanna, would you be able to watch my daughter so my wife and I can have a date day? And she's like, yeah, sure. Why don't you stay over for 2 or 3 nights? And I'm like, nah, mom, I can't do that. And she was really offended. And she was like, all right, fine, don't come then. And I was like, what, mom? I was like, this is very reminiscent of like also what I was growing up with, in a way, like kind of withdrawing. Now, I'm like, all right, I took a deep breath. I'm like, all right, this is very reminiscent of also a mom, my mom who didn't have a mom, didn't have emotional kind of that connection, you know, disrupted, all that stuff. But this is what it came down to. I asked her the next day, we were talking on the phone, we cleared the air. And then I said, mom, this is something I've been noticing about how you've been, like what I described to you. What came about was that she said, you know, the more y'all are growing older and having kids, the more I'm growing older. Folks can relate. And she said, we left Afghanistan so you can have a life. And I don't think I'm gonna be around to really see you enjoy that. You know, this is like really, like they sacrificed so much to get me here, and they can't really reap the full rewards of it. They're satisfied knowing that the possibility would be there. So that's the inner landscape of what I wanted to share with you, and I want to invite as much questions that we have time for. Yeah.
So, have you written about any?
Written up?
Written about any?
I have a chapter published in the Islamic Chaplaincy book that just is getting published tomorrow. So there's something in there, but it's called the Jihad of Self-Realization, but not in the term, the Jihad means struggle, not holy war, but it's a struggle of self-realization and human growth. I need to kind of baseline terms.
Yeah. I'm listening to you talk about it. Two things came to mind.
Yeah.
One is your Maggie Bright book.
Yeah. Comforting?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you for the invitation. Appreciate it. Yeah. What other curiosities? Feel free to be as direct as you'd like, honestly. You can even think about like the folks that y'all are kind of shepherding in a way too, if you have any questions about that, yeah.
So you came experienced a different culture. We are trying to understand that the culture that you came from, that we will be sponsoring a family. How were there people with Christian values that treated you well, or and what was your response to sort of that alien culture, and what might have made it better?
I think maybe you can hold on to the microphone just to clarify so you can clarify things if I don't, depending on where I go. Number one, the hospitality that that Christian organization gave for my family to come to America, that was a value, right? I mean, talk about in terms of like Christianity, like missionary work, we have benefited from that stuff, right? So I mean, that's a value. So let me see, what else did you say? The alienation?
Well, did you feel alienated? Were there points that, in retrospect, I mean, in observing how that organization whoever from the other side could have done a better job? I mean, certainly, I'm not sure where the bullying came from, but that was hopefully not from the culture, but from other aspects of it.
Yeah. Clearly, I can unpack this, and this is to your point. Part of the struggle for here is like when I'm opening up my life story, what parts do I mention to you? So this is something I can give you. I can give you an anecdote. I wasn't there, but I know this because my mom told me this. When they first came here, my sister, was diagnosed with malaria. So now they're in America, literally day two. She has malaria. She's in the hospital. My mom and my two sisters are in the hospital. They're tending to her malaria. My dad is with the brothers. How easy do you think it is going to be for him to come to the hospital? Not easy, because he doesn't speak English. There is no Google Translate. He's stuck for a whole week at home and wondering, how do I even connect to my wife? We have cell phones today that wasn't even possible then. It's about the communication, I think, more than anything else. So when we think about empowerment, I think if my parents had an English or like something to help support their needs in terms of actual language, that would have helped. You're not going to be able to remove so much of the discomfort, the suffering that comes from like these tangible realities. Like they literally shifted. They're literally displaced, even the folks who are coming here now. But the question is more about, like, even like the language itself. How do you communicate needs? And that's at the least that. And then that's like Maslow's hierarchy of needs. We're trying to like meet those fundamental ones. You're not going to be able to necessarily affirm all their self-worth and belonging and all those other aspects. But at the least, you start with the communication part. And that's exactly what my mom and dad said, that they wish they had someone to help them speak, get their needs known. So long as these folks, including my parents that come here, they weren't born yesterday, they know what it's like to want water, want food, want housing, any of these critical needs. And it's about how do they translate that, those needs. So the alienation is like more of a lived experience. It's not. Yeah, my bullying at that point, no, I could speak fluent English, all that stuff. Part of it was the otherness of where do I fit in, and me also placing myself in these situations where I could be abused, where they're exploiting their power because they noticed how much I want from them. They were also hurting, and I was hurting, and two hurts coming together in this way led to more hurt for me at the least. Yeah.
Hey. How you talked about courting your wife in a beautiful way.
Yeah.
And I guess the question, it sounds like it was not an arranged marriage.
That's correct.
So could you talk about your courtship maybe, and also what your family's reaction was to it not being arranged? Were you under any pressure?
Yeah. So partly in the Afghan tradition, it's more so pre-arranged, meaning that here's girl, here's boy, you guys talk. If you want to get together, then move forward with it. If not, it's okay. that's been mostly the experience in Afghan culture, it prearranged, because they're trying to set up not two people to get married necessarily, but also two families. Now, I already knew that my wife today was going to be like a hot hit. Like, it was going to work. I already knew that. My mom and mother-in-law knew each other. They grew up, and you know, that was partly how I met her. It was like at a more of like this like bigger family function. I saw her. I was like, yeah, you know, let me see if I could try to get her email and could contact her through this means. And so, but it was doing online emailing. And when I was like 19, 20 was 19 when 19 years old, 20 years old was still hard. It's a lot of time for, you know, sexual frustration, just like not understanding each other frustration, like how do we meet each other kind of frustration, all that for 2 years. But we stuck it through. My biggest concern in our marriage at that, the courting period was, like I told you, I was 19, 20, 21. I'm in this space of trying to integrate my worldviews. Religion and spirituality became and Islam became like the foundational stone, and I'm like, if I'm gonna marry someone, I also want to know that they're gonna be able to indulge in this world too, because I'm thinking about the tradition that I want to leave behind for my children. That was part of what I was assessing with her, and she was more so in the very much assimilation space and really shedding her identity, other than family values. And so that was part of the struggle that we had in our relationship, where I think once her grandmother died, she realized something that, you know, oh, there's something more to this world. I wished her grandmother still lived, you know, in a way. But it became this dual kind of thing. There was a sadness to it, but then there was some kind of benefit to our relationship later on, too. So, yeah, you'll...
When you were courting, and yeah. You've talked about your relationships to women when you were courting and when you were starting college. Has that changed or developed? I'd like to hear where you are today.
Yeah, well, I'm happy to say that I'm in a monogamous relationship today.
Okay.
But I know where you're getting at. So I was talking. I think you probably might have been referring to the male-female modesty. So what happened back to that period of time that I mentioned, being in that school environment and like men and women and shaking hands of that nature, and noticing the stress that I was under, and I noticed the stress was bringing to others, I noticed that for me, within the Islamic law that I was following, that it presented an opportunity for deeper reflection. And so I learned about this experience of being able to take conscientious pause on rulings. Not that I would teach or like preach it to others, but where I would take pause on that ruling because it doesn't make sense. So I decided to forego that ruling about male and female kind of shaking hands of that nature. And that was also grounded in my Islam as well. I learned that there was roots for that. So it wasn't that I was escaping Islam, I was actually going deeper into the practice of it. And so that also kind of impacted this experience of integration. I wasn't assimilating necessarily. I was going deeper into my tradition, trying to understand it more deeply, and actually get closer into my relationship with God, trying to understand the context of why that was so in these pre-modern spaces, and why it doesn't really, those rationale for today isn't going to lead to toward your dishonor. Where in those cases, it would have. It could, I mean, and so there's a lot of frames that are different. And so that was partly what helped me also stay grounded in my tradition and my faith. And I was growing in that way. I think that that's what, yeah, yeah.
All right, thank you so much. Unfortunately, we're running up against time, but really appreciate you coming and speaking with us, Yavad.
Yeah.
Maybe you can stay back in case there's any questions and we can have more one-on-one conversations. But thanks so much for joining, and hope everyone comes back next week as we get on our website.
Thank you.
Yeah. My name is Ned Walthall, and I'm a photographer.
Yeah.
And I'm working with my wife, who is a writer, and we're working on a book called COVID and Faith, which we interview people about their experiences of COVID through the lens of faith.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if we could talk to you.
Yeah.
Would that be okay? I can give you a card. You could either...